Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. I want to thank Mira for coming to speak with us. I'll keep this short since I'm assuming most of y'all are not here to see me. So please help me welcome Mira Jacob.
Hi, thank you so much for coming out. This is amazing. I was kind of scared that I was going to be reading to two people, and this just feels so wonderful to see you all. And I also just want you all to know that so many people have come from my high school and grade school experience that this is like nothing but love. So thanks, you guys, for coming. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about the book, and then I'm going to read to you. So one thing that you should know about this book is that it took me 10 years to write. And I like to tell people that before I get started, because I think a lot of times people that come to these readings are writers themselves. Or they're working on a creative project, and there were many, many times that I almost gave up on this. And I think it's just really important to know it takes a long time sometimes to get out your story, and there's just don't lose faith in your process or what it looks like, because I almost did several times, and I'm so glad I didn't, because this story finally came out. I'm going to read to you from the prologue. You don't really need to know a whole lot, and I prefer just to jump right in. So what I'm going to do is jump right in, and if you have questions afterwards, I will gladly answer them. This is Prologue, A Chosen Madness. Seattle, June 1998. It was a fever, a hot rage of words. For three nights in a row, Thomas Eppen sat on the porch, one side of a furious conversation rolling over his tongue to spill out the window screen. Their neighbors heard him. His wife, Kamala, could not sleep. Prince Philip, their aging and arthritic Labrador, had taken to pacing the hallway and whining. Kamala told her daughter all of this over the phone early one June evening, her voice as smooth as a newscaster's. "I am thinking he's on his way out," Kamala concluded, and Amina pictured her father at the edge of the desert, waiting for a bus.
"Really?"
"Who knows? My judgment is impairing. I haven't slept since Saturday."
"You're kidding."
"Not kidding," sniffed Kamala, whose ability to sleep through anything her insomniac husband could cook up had long been a point of pride. Amina dropped her keys to the kitchen counter.
"You're just now home from work?"
"Yeah." Amina placed her mail and camera next to the keys. The answering machine blinked furiously at her. She turned her back to it.
"Three nights? Seriously?"
"How's work?"
"Busy. Everyone in Seattle is getting married next month."
"You're not."
Amina ignored her. "What do you mean talking? Talking about what?"
"Telling stories."
"What kind of stories?"
"What kind of anything? Fits and nuts, and now this man with his idiot yak-yak all the time. I told him his tongue would fall out and rot like one vegetable, and still he won't shut up."
"You always say that."
"No, I don't."
"Ma."
"But this is different, Koche."
Kamala sighed. Night noises snaked up through the phone line, pressing New Mexico right up to Amina's ear. The hushed applause of the wind rolling through the cottonwoods, the hollow scritch of crickets echoing against the mesas, the click of the gate latch in the garden. Amina shut her eyes and felt herself back in the darkening yard with the tickle of wild grass on her knees.
"You out in the kitchen?"
"Mm-hmm.
You in the rain?"
"I'm in the kitchen." Amina checked the linoleum under her boots.
"How's the weather?"
Kamala asked. "It's raining a little."
"Nobody knows why you stay there."
"You get used to it."
"That's not a good reason to stay somewhere. No wonder that dirty man shot himself. All that time without sun and this devil woman tearing her pantyhoses."
"Kurt Cobain was a junkie, Ma."
"Because he needed more sun."
I mean, aside. Had she known that leaving her copy of Rolling Stone in the bathroom on her last visit would make Kamala a self-proclaimed expert on all things Seattle? The grunges! The Starbucks! The startups! She might have been more careful, but then again, it served a good enough purpose, this disdain her mother held for her choice of residence. For one, it cut down on her visits. I never get warm here, Kamala said once, rubbing her hands together and looking around suspiciously. And once she had even told a nice barista at Amina's local coffee shop that he smelled funny from too much of damp. Did I tell you the mint is coming like one forest, bigger than last year? That's great. Amina opened her refrigerator, a collection of takeout boxes slumped together like old men in bad weather. She shut it. I made chutney and had the Ramakrishnas and Kurians over last night, and they loved it. Bala wanted the recipe, of course. What did you leave out? Nothing. Cayenne and cilantro. Cooking was a talent of her mother's that Amina often thought of as evolutionary, a way for Kamala to survive herself with friendships intact. Like plumage that expanded to rainbow, an otherwise unremarkable bird, Kamala's ability to transform raw ingredients into sumptuous meals brought her the kind of love her personality on its own might have repelled. So what did they think about Dad?
What about Dad?
Well, the talking or whatever.
I didn't tell them. Don't be stupid.
It's a secret? You're not telling the family? A secret between the Ramakrishnas, the Kurians, and the Eepins only happened once in 5 years or so, and usually came out within months anyways, the keepers assuring the kept from that it was nothing personal, just family business, the kept from uttering comforting words about being family in this country anyway, even though no blood relation existed among them.
No secret, Kamala said a bit too emphatically.
She tucked her voice lower.
No big deals. Let's not bother anyone about it, okay?
Well, did anyone else think he was acting funny?
He isn't acting funny.
I thought you just said...
No, not like that. He's going to work and all. He's fine with everyone else. All the nurses in the OR still follow him around like gaggling geese. It's just late at night.
It would have to be late at night. Thomas did his best to stay at the hospital until sundown, and his insomnia often kept him up between midnight and 6 a.m. Those were the hours he would sit on the porch and tinker some unfathomable object, a cricket gun, a pet petter, into life. He's probably just talking to the dog, Ma. He does that all the time.
No, he's not.
How do you know?
I just told you. The dog is stuck inside whining, and beside, I heard him.
And?
He was talking to Amichi.
Amina stopped moving. Her grandmother had been dead for almost 20 years.
You mean praying to her? No, I don't. I mean talking, telling stories.
Stories?
Kamala huffed and ripped up weeds. Rip, rip, grunt. Ma, just stupid stories. How you won the photography award in the 10th grade. How I begged that man at Hickory Farms to order some ginger pickle in 1982, and then that nuts goes and orders candy ginger.
Right in front of you? You were standing right there?
I listened from the laundry room.
To live in the Eepin's house was to acknowledge the sharpness of invisible borders, the separations that had divided it like two countries since 1983. It had been years since Amina had seen her mother wade into the yellow light of her father's porch, and as far as she knew, Thomas had never once crossed the gate into Kamala's garden. And you're sure it was Amichi?
He said he could see her.
What are you talking about?
He told her to go sit somewhere else.
What? Yes, and I think maybe he saw... Kamala's voice trailed off into silence, the world of grief that lived invisibly between all the Eepins revealing itself like a face waiting behind the curtains. Who? Who else did he see?
I don't know.
Her mother sounded far away.
Ma, Amina said, worried. Now, is he depressed? Don't be dumb, Kamala huffed.
A flurry of activity released over the phone line in what sounded like something heavy being dragged.
No one is depressed. I'm just telling you is all, just like that. I'm sure you're right, it's fine, it's nothing.
But if he thinks he's seeing...
Oh, Okay, talk to you later.
No, wait. What? Well, is Dad around? Can I talk to him?
He's at the hospital. Some big case. Some young mother hit her head on the bottom of the pool 2 days ago and hasn't woken up.
The Epins had never spared their daughter the details of her father's work, so even at 5 years of age, Amina often heard things like, her medulla has a ski pole lodged into it, or his wife shot him in the face, but he should live.
Are you sure he should be working right now?
Amina had gone into surgery with her father once in second grade. She remembered the sharp, bitter smell of the operating room, the glint of her father's eyes over the mask, the way the floor rushed up to greet her when his scalpel ran a red seam down the back of his first patient's head. She'd spent the rest of the day eating candy at the nurse's station.
He's fine, Kamala said. It's not like that. You're not listening.
I am listening. You just told me he's delusional, and I'm asking...
I did not say he's delusional. I said he was talking to his mother.
Who is dead?
Obvious!
And that's not delusional?
There are choices, Amina. Choices we make as human beings on this planet Earth. If somebody decides to let the devil in, then of course they will see demons everywhere they look. This is not delusional. This is weakness.
You can't really think that. It was a wish more than a statement of fact, as Amina was well aware that Kamala, with her Jesus, religious radio shows, and ability to misquote the Bible at random, could and did believe anything she wanted to.
I am just reporting the facts, her mother said.
Right. Okay, listen, I gotta get going.
You just came home. Where are you going?
Out.
Now? With who?
Dimple.
Dimple.
Her mother repeated like a curse. According to Kamala, Dimple Kurian had been afflicted with low morality since the day her parents gave her that ridiculous name for giggly Gujarati starlets. According to Dimple, Kamala had a Jesus complex where her heart should be.
Is she still opening relationships?
Open relationships, Ma, they're called... Never mind, yes.
So she can be with one boy and another all in 1 week.
Dating.
Chee! Dirty thing! No wonder they had to send her to reform school. You'd run around with everyone and cry, oh no, he thinks I'm a whore, he thinks I'm a whore, when he thinks you're a whore.
When have you ever seen Dimple cry about anything?
I've seen it in the movies. Henry meets Sally.
When Harry met Sally?
Yes! This stupid girl is with too many men and crying about nobody loves me, and then she goes with that poor boy and expects him to love her.
You think that's what When Harry Met Sally is about?
And then what is he supposed to do? Commit with her?
He does commit to her, Mom. That's how the movie ends.
Not afterward. Afterward, he leaves her.
Her mother's conviction that movies continued in some private off-screen world had always been as baffling as it was irrefutable. Whole plots had found themselves victims to Kamala's reimagining, happy endings derailed, tragedies righted.
And anyway, someone should tell Dimple to call home. How can her parents know she's okay if she doesn't call?
Because I see her every day and I would tell you.
Inconsiderate so-and-so. And Bala gets so worried about her, you know.
Tell Bala Auntie she's fine. And I'll call Dad tomorrow. There was a round silence on the other end of the line. Had she hung up?
Ma? Don't call.
What?
It's not something for the phone.
Amina blinked at her cabinets in disbelief.
So what? I've got to wait until I fly home to talk to him?
Oh, Kamala said, voice rich with feigned surprise. Sure, if you think it's best.
What?
When can you come?
Wait, really?
Amina looked in panic at the kitchen wall, where a bright list of to-dos for the Beale wedding hung like an accusation.
It's June, Ma. It's some big thing, so don't come.
No, it's just a bad time. It's my busiest time.
Oh, yes, I understand. It's only your father.
Oh, stop. I'll come if you really need me to. I will. Amina pressed her fingers to her eyelids, leaving work in the middle of the high season insane. Her mother took a deep breath.
Yes. That would be very nice if you could manage it.
Amina pulled the receiver away from her ear, staring at it. She had never heard a sentence sound less like it could have come from Kamala's mouth, but there it was, her mother's attempt at accommodation as discordant as a hidden message in a record played backward. Something is wrong. Something is really wrong.
I'll get a ticket out next week, Amina found herself saying.
She paused hopefully, waiting for a never mind, a don't bother. Instead, she heard a long, strained grunt and the satisfying chorus of roots popping up from the ground. The muffled thwack of palms against pants beat through the phone line, and Amina saw her mother as she would be in that moment, standing in the garden, tiny puffs of cottonwood dander floating around her hair like dusk fairies.
Okay, then, Kamala said. Come home.
Cast up there.
So the story, just to give you a brief idea, starts that way. Amina gets a call from her mother, needs to go home, finds out her father is seeing something, and it's actually two stories that are sort of told in parallel. And what you do in the course of the book is you unwind them both at the same time. You're kind of figuring out two mysteries at the same time, when one is, what is Thomas Eapen seeing right now and what has happened to him? And the other is, what happened in his past to make this moment come to being? So it's a big story. It's a family story. If you go in for that sort of thing, I think you'll like it. Does anyone have any questions for me? Someone? Anyone? Yeah. I will totally come and read it to you. Yeah. You know, actually, I did the audiobook for this. Yeah, how weird is that? I did. It was a really crazy, and I'll tell you the story, which is kind of weird. So I'm obviously not an actress, but they had me audition to do it, and I don't know if you guys have ever been in those sound booths, but they're like this big, and they're padded on all sides with black foamy material with nothing but a mic, and there was a window that I couldn't really see out of, and there was what I called
the voice of God.
It was the producer who every once in a while I would say something, and he'd say,
"You stuttered,"
and I would have to do it again. But the thing is that I really kind of hit a groove reading this. And one of the things that happened in the course of writing this book is, I'm going to back up a minute and tell you that this book has a father in it. And when I had originally written it, there had been a different father in it, a lovely father, a father I really liked as a character. And then my father in real life started dying of cancer. And in the time that he was dying, I couldn't write a word of it, because I knew that I was going to be writing about something happening to a father, and it just became impossible to write. So I put it away for 3 years. When I came back to it, I started putting my father in the book, and part of that was just I missed him. And I also thought the entire time that maybe I was going crazy by doing that. But I just did it, and I think it was my way of grieving. Was just to put, and it's not his life, none of these things happened to him, but you know how well we know our parents, right, and their mannerisms and the way that they move across the room and all of those things that you really love and miss about someone. So I put him in here, and then when the book sold, it was sort of this amazing miracle. But the one sad thing about this for me is that my father never obviously saw this book or realized or never saw it kind of come to fruition. So when I'm in that booth, I'm in that sound booth, right, and I can't see, and I've got the guy talking to me in my ears, and I'm reading this book, which is, you know, 500 pages, thank you very much, for the first time I'm reading something, and all of these accents, and you kind of go to another place to do that. You're sort of in Mars. And I was doing that, and then somewhere in the middle of it, I had this moment of total magical thinking, which I think it was the weirdest thing, but I suddenly was really convinced that I had my dad on the telephone in this way. Like, I felt like I was reading it to him, and that he could hear me. And it was this really, it was really actually amazing, because I kept getting up every day. I mean, it was 6-hour days,
to get this story in and for 7 or 8 days. And I would get up and I was on fire to get to the recording studio, because every time I got in there, and I wouldn't look up for hours because I didn't want to know that he wasn't there. And I would read and read and read. And it was actually just this amazing thing. And then finally what happened was the day that it was ending, I didn't want to go, because who wants to hang up that phone? No one wants to hang up that phone. But I went, and, you know, I'd had this incredible director and producer in the studio with me, and they were really invested in the story, and they did not read ahead, so they didn't know, what was happening. And it got to the point where I got to the end of the book, and I just couldn't read the end. And I'm a person that has a hard time crying by myself, even like to myself by myself. And I found myself sobbing in a room where they can hear your stomach gurgling. I was having like choking, like snot filled sobs. And I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And it was so sweet, actually, because they did this really sweet thing, which is that nobody said, stop. Nobody said, to take a few minutes. Nobody, all the guy said was, we're just here. Just do what you need to do. We'll be here when you're ready. And nobody said any weird platitudes, right? The platitudes that you have to like slap off because someone's told you something silly that doesn't take care of the hurt in your heart. Nobody said anything stupid. They just let me have that moment. And, it was really nice. And then I got up and I sort of finished it. And I kind of hung up the phone, and I left there feeling like something enormous had happened to me. Like I'd changed body sizes or something. It was really interesting. You didn't even ask that question. See how much I can talk when no one even asks a question? It's amazing. Does anyone else have a question? I promise it won't take half an hour. Yeah. My whole life, as anyone with Indian parents knows. I'm sure your children have it too. We've all got it in our back pocket. Don't think we don't. Yeah, you in the back.
I have a ton of questions, but I won't ask much of the spoiler.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, this is the question, in case you guys didn't hear it, is how did I decide? This is about a photographer. And it's a photographer whose life has been derailed by a specific photo she took. So she's kind of gone from being a photojournalist to taking pictures of weddings. But the great thing about her is that she gets all the, like, terrible parts of weddings. She gets all the good parts, too. But you know how weddings always have those really unseemly times when, like, everybody's trying to act so nice, so inevitably someone's getting murdered in the corner? So she always gets, the bad, ugly moments. And the reason that I chose it is because this character, this person is a watcher, and she watches everything that happens, and she's somebody that's almost immobilized by all of the things she's seen. But what people never seem to put together about photography, which I think is really true, is it is a really it's a equally passive and aggressive and active, you know, action. When you are deciding what to take pictures of, when you are the watcher and when you are taking those pictures in, it's a very aggressive thing. So to me, this was the best way to get at a character who couldn't really, she's not a confrontational person, but in those photographs, she can be confrontational. I also just see things in pictures, so that was helpful. Yeah. Anyone else? Yes. In the back as well. And then I'll get to you. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a great question. When did I start self-identifying as a writer? I would say by second grade, I was writing books and long poems. But because I'm Indian, it took me until I was 28 to actually say that I was a writer. Because every time I did, I just pictured my mother going, oh, no, no, no. And I joke with my mother. I joked with her this time when I saw her. I was like, you would still be happy if I were to turn to you today and say, I'm going to be a doctor. And she said, are you interested in being a doctor? I'm like, no. Took a while. So, yeah, Stephanie. How do you know when you're done is the question. So there's a little story behind that for this, which is that I knew I was done because the reason, so this book took me 10 years and I was working kind of increasingly just really high powered and stressful corporate jobs and very cutthroat. And in the last one, and I kept wanting to have time to write, but that meant that I was basically writing from 11 at night till 1 in the morning every night. I had a son, I lost my father, and New York is tough. And so what happened is I walked into work one day thinking I was going to have a normal talk with my boss, and instead they said, we're letting you go and we're replacing you with 5 20-year-old interns. Great. So I met my husband under Brooklyn Bridge, bawling my eyes out, and I said, oh my God, I failed us. And he said, no, because you know what? You've been trying to write this book forever, and you have 3 months of severance. So why don't you just pretend that's you getting paid to write the book and finish the book? So the reason I knew I was done is because I was on a crazy fevered deadline with a dwindling bank account. And it was like suns through the hourglass. Those are the, like, I felt life force is draining out of me. I must write. And I remember when I wrote the last sentence of the book, because I actually stood up. This is so embarrassing to admit this to you guys. I stood up and I went like this. Like I did that alone in my office. Like I walked around like I was Rocky. And I knew I was done, just because it's sort of like when you just land something. I just felt like, oh no, I just landed it. That was it. And it was the same. No one ever took away that sentence. It's the same sentence that ends the book. And it was exactly where I needed to go. So yeah, that's my answer to your question. Anyone else? Yeah. I think my mother's sort of on board with it, mostly. No, my mother's been great, actually, in this process. So the thing I'll tell you about my mother is everyone, because I wrote a note in here so people wouldn't confuse this mother with my mother, because my mother was this very cool, very cultured, and very curious person. And she and my father moved to New Mexico in the late 60s. And one of the great, great gifts that both of my parents gave me was this ability to be curious and to never stop being curious. So she was this kind of intellectual, you know, in the middle of the desert without a lot of context, without a lot of friends at first. And she just sought out a lot of information, and she became a feminist. And, you know, she was the one that, like, I don't know if you guys remember that movie Heathers, but as a 13-year-old girl, that's a movie that changes your life. And my mother was the one that took me to that and all the movies that, you know, The Guild, and kind of got me going culturally. So I think despite her not being totally comfortable with me being a writer, I think she's secretly happy about what it gives to my life and what it gives to hers. I am working on a new book too. I can't tell you what it's about because that will doom it. But I will tell you, in 10 years, I will meet you right here. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Do you remember exactly what happened that made you pick it up and start writing?
Yes, I do. So two things happened. One is that when I stopped writing it, it was because I had been trying to write a passage about the father where he's finding out something about himself medically, and I just was immobilized because too much of my life was hospital rooms and bad news and losing somebody that you love. And so I remember I shut it away like it was a demon. And I remember I started writing it again because this is so funny, I've never answered this question. I was in New York and I went through a moment when I actually was sort of going crazy with grief, where I was convinced that my dad was in any number of buildings in Midtown. And I would tell myself in the subway on the way home, if you return to 42nd Street and go to number 142 and go to the fourth floor and to the fifth door and open it, your dad will be... Like, I would tell myself this. And I would try to see if I had the guts to go to that place. And I never did. And I realized it was some weird... I think it was just my brain trying to wrap around the fact that I wasn't going to see him again. And then I remember thinking, like, you're going to drive yourself nuts with this. You're going to drive yourself with this empty feeling of you. I think I felt like I was missing my connection to meet him. Like I wasn't getting on the right train. And I was like, take that feeling and put it somewhere, put it anywhere else, but don't put it into this, because this is going to make you lose your mind. So I started writing again, the weekend that I kind of had that realization. Yeah. That is so desperately sad. I just want you to know it's a funny book. It is a funny book. Anyone else? Yeah.
So I'm curious about I write nonfiction.
Yeah.
And I'm endlessly fascinated by people who write fiction and that process. So can you talk a little bit about how your characters, you know, do they come to you?
Yeah, yeah, sure. Well, yes. So I've just read you some of my favorite character, which is the mother in here, Kamala. And I have to tell you, Kamala came whole. She literally, like, I was writing a scene, and all of a sudden, Kamala was speaking. And I was doing everything to keep up with Kamala, and she was a really interesting character for me because, and I'm sure there are some of you that write here that know this weird thing that happens where sometimes you have a character come into a scene and they take over. And Kamala was such a force of nature for me that I would try to write the scene the way I thought it should be done, and Kamala would stand on the side going, "No, no." Just, I swear, and I would be like, "No, you're gonna do this thing," and she's like, "No, I'm not doing that." And I would just have to like kind of sit with my mind quietly and let her unwind, which was such a weird, and I'd had that in little bits before because I'd written short stories, but this was my first attempt at a book. And so I lived with her for years being in my head. And the same thing with Akhil, the brother in here, really just kind of came on like a storm. And then I felt like I was just trying to catch up to them the whole time, trying to get down the right things. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Anyone else? Yeah, Sarah.
This book has been published in so many years.
Yes.
The interpretation of the publishers about the title seems to be so different. What is the
The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing. Why did I choose that title? Yeah. So one of the things that happens in this book is there are many sleeping disorders that result in a lot of different outcomes for the family. And there is in particular a sleepwalker in here who is just, he's so wrecked and he sets off an event that has ramifications for decades in this family. And the idea with that is that... first of all, I thought that if an immigrant, the perfect disease for an immigrant family would actually be something of the subconscious. Because as an immigrant, I can tell you, a lot of what you spend your day doing is trying to bend your body into a certain way and look a certain way and act a certain way so that people won't recognize you as different. And so they won't feel like you are not one of them. And I went through all of mid school and high school sort of contorting myself wildly to do this. And it made sense to me that what happened at night, I feel like what makes sense to me about this is at night, it's just your body wreaks havoc on that part of you that is trying to be something that it really isn't yet. And so that's what was happening with these characters, is they all had these dreams and these desires, and at night their subconscious were just going crazy. But this is a really hopeful title for me, because this was a title of, you know, this man in particular and the thing he did, he'd always wanted to be a dancer. And so the idea there is, what if all of that anger in us could find a way out? What if it could find its way into beauty and a way into kind of sustaining, you know, a sustaining life force? And for me, this is actually a book of a lot of hope. And that's why I had to put that title on it. Yeah. Thanks for asking. Anyone else? Yes. It was, yeah, it was purely having lived there. And I am a New Mexico, you know, I'm a native New Mexican, and I have a lot of, I have a lot of love for that state and that landscape. I think that once you have lived in New Mexico, especially if you were born and raised there, you never get over the land. It's your kind of first real love in life. I'm seeing the New Mexicans totally nodding their heads, right? It's like your first boyfriend. You always love that land. So I had to set it there. And Seattle I had lived in as well, and during some kind of awkward years, so it felt like a great place to kind of set that. Yeah. All right, I'm going to be up here signing books. If you all would like to buy one, I would love to sign them for you. And I just say this because it's always hard to say this in an event like this when you see so many people out, but getting fiction out into the world is really hard, actually. It's really, really hard. So if you like this book, please tell somebody. And if you're working on something of your own, just please keep going at it, because I think it actually changes the way that our world functions when we get those things out. All right, thanks, guys.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour.
I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.